Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now, with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help get your job the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/arts. Just go to Indeed.com/arts right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/arts. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.
Welcome back to The Deep Dive. Today we're taking on a subject who, well, seems to defy time itself, doesn't he? And maybe conventional career paths, too.
He really does.
Paul Rudd. Impossibly consistent, undeniably charming, and, as we'll get into, surprisingly multifaceted.
Yeah, this is a really compelling mission for us, I think, because Paul Rudd, he sort of occupies this unique space in Hollywood, you know?
Like duality.
Exactly. The reliable ensemble guy, the supporting player for years, right? And then somehow, in his late 40s, he pivots and becomes the lead, the absolute anchor of a massive superhero franchise.
It's quite the jump.
It is. So today we're aiming to go beyond just the Ant-Man suit. We want to uncover the specifics, those surprisingly global roots he has, and really dig into the work ethic that seems to be behind that famous natural charm.
Okay, let's start grounding this with some, you know, foundational stats that kind of illustrate that strange duality you mentioned.
Right.
Paul Stephen Rudd, born April 6, 1969, Passaic, New Jersey. His acting debut, way back in 1991.
1991, just think about that longevity. It's astounding. And it's not like he picked early. He's getting major recognition right now.
Mm-hmm. Like the Forbes Celebrity 100 list in 2019.
Yeah.
Serious financial and cultural impact.
Huge impact. And then, you know, that pop culture moment in 2021, People Magazine's Sexiest Man Alive.
Can't forget that one.
You really can't. And this is a guy whose career stretches from, like, indie cult films all the way to these global blockbusters.
And crucially, it's not just about the blockbusters or the comedy, even though that's, you know, his main brand. If you dig into the sources, his resume is quietly picking up some serious awards buzz.
That's a really important point. He already has a Critics' Choice Television Award,
Specifically
for guest work, which is interesting.
Yeah.
And then more recently, the prestige stuff is getting noticed. A Golden Globe nomination for Living With Yourself, that dual role was tough.
Very tough.
Two Screen Actors Guild Awards across his career, and just this year, 2024, two Primetime Emmy nominations. And they're for completely different kinds of performance.
Right, that recent duality, the serious recognition alongside the franchise stuff, That's really why we're doing this deep dive, isn't it?
Exactly.
Our mission, then, is to trace his path, kind of chronologically. We want to reveal how this blends of intense classical training and that very natural self-deprecating humor created someone so authentic he could conquer improv comedy And the MCU. Okay, so to really get the Paul Rudd origin story, we got to push past that image, you know, the always cheerful Midwest guy. The sources paint a much more global picture.
They really do. Yeah, he was born in New Jersey, sure, but his parents were English Jewish immigrants.
That's foundational, isn't it?
Yeah.
Must have shaped his early cultural world quite a bit.
Absolutely. His father, Michael Rudd, he passed away in 2008, had this really interesting job, historical tour guide for TWA.
Trans World Airlines.
Okay.
That explains some moving around, maybe.
Definitely. And his mother, Gloria Irene Granville, she was a sales manager at KSMO TV, the station in Kansas City, Missouri.
So, the English connection is strong, but they settled in the U.S. Can you give us the specifics on the London roots? I find this fascinating.
Both parents, yeah. Originally from London, his dad from Edgware, his mom from Surbiton.
Wow.
But it goes deeper. Their families were descended from Ashkenazi Jewish immigrants who'd come to England from Eastern Europe. We're talking Belarus, Poland, Russia.
That is not the typical Hollywood backstory.
Not at all. And get this, this detail from the sources just kind of blew me away. His parents were second cousins.
No way. Really?
Yeah. It points to how tight-knit those immigrant communities were back then, you know, settling in England.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
So this rich global heritage, it was part of his childhood, even growing up mostly in the States.
Seems like it. We know he loved reading British comics, The Beano and The Dandy. His uncle used to send them over.
That's a great detail.
And he even had his bar mitzvah service in Ontario, Canada. Maybe something to do with his dad's TWA travel schedule.
Could be. Okay, so lots of international threads, but Kansas. Kansas is where he really became, well, Paul Rudd as we know him.
Right. The family moved to Lenexa, Kansas, that's in Johnson County, when he was 10, though they did have a 3-year stint in Anaheim, California, again, because of his father's job.
Kansas stuck.
Yeah.
He graduated from Shawnee Mission West High School in 87. And the sources mentioned something interesting about high school, not just acting, but forensics.
Yeah. Competitive public speaking. Specifically, he placed 5th nationally in humorous interpretation in 1987.
Humorous interpretation. Okay, for those listening who aren't familiar, what exactly is that and why is it maybe important for his career later?
That's a great question. Humorous interpretation, or HI, it's basically performing a funny piece like from a play or a story totally solo. No props, no costumes. It's all about your voice, your physical comedy, your timing. You have to make it work. It's like competitive charisma training, but disciplined.
Huh. I like that. Discipline, charisma.
Exactly. It teaches you comedic timing, how to hold a stage. Perfect training for ensemble comedy, right? Where timing is everything.
Makes total sense. So he's got this competitive edge, and he keeps going academically. University of Kansas, majoring in theater, joins Sigma Nu fraternity, too.
Mm-hmm. But his training didn't stop there. He got serious about it.
Right after KU.
He studied at the American Academy of Dramatic Arts in New York, a prestigious place. Actually studied alongside Matthew Lillard there.
Oh, interesting connection.
Yeah. But the real kicker, the thing that maybe separates him from a lot of other comedians, is the international study.
He went to England, right? Oxford.
He did. Spent 3 months studying Jacobean drama at the British American Drama Academy in Oxford.
Jacobean drama. Okay, we're talking serious complex stuff. Plays written right after Shakespeare.
Exactly. Intense tragedy, satire, really heightened language. Think Webster, Middleton.
So why does studying like complex tragedy help you when you end up in Anchorman?
Well, I think it gives you gravitas. You know, if you can handle that language, those big emotions, you have the tools to anchor anything, even something totally absurd.
Ah, okay. It gives depth.
Yeah. The technical skill, the emotional weight. Mm-hmm. It means later on he could handle dramatic roles or maybe more importantly, carry a massive franchise like Ant-Man. Scott Lang isn't just jokes, right? There's heart there.
True. All that classical training, though, must have cost a bit. How did he actually pay for it all?
This is where the biography gets really good. The sources give us two amazing sort of contrasting jobs he had.
Okay, let's hear them.
While he was at acting school, he worked as a DJ for bar mitzvahs.
Get out.
Seriously, imagine like studying intense drama all day, then spinning records and leading the hora at night.
That's incredible range right there.
And it gets even better, or maybe just more specific. After he graduated, he had this job that sounds like it's straight out of one of his comedies. He worked glazing hams.
Glazing hams.
At the Holiday Ham Company in Overland Park, Kansas. Just picture it. The future movie star carefully applying glaze to holiday hams.
Wow. That is perfect. It somehow captures the whole grounded, unexpected journey.
Doesn't it? Glazing hams to fund a career built on like Shakespearean rigor and competitive charisma. It really sets the stage for the kind of performer he became.
So, okay, he's got the education, that mix of precise timing from forensics, the seriousness of Jacobean drama, and the practical skills of ham glazing.
Can't forget the ham glazing.
Never. He officially launches his screen career in the early 90s.
Yeah.
But maybe not with the kind of role you'd expect after all that training.
No, the very first credit our sources list is a commercial from 1991. Promoting the Super Nintendo.
And here's where his career feels almost surreal, right? Because he actually referenced that exact commercial decades later in like 2025 for the Nintendo Switch 2.
That's amazing. Talk about coming full circle.
It really is. It's part of his appeal, I think. Before the big movie break, though, he had a pretty significant run on TV, a recurring role on Sisters, the drama series. Started in 92.
Yeah, Kirby Quimby Philby, quite a name. He stayed with that show until 1995, getting that experience, you know, the grind of weekly television.
In 1995, that was a pivotal year, wasn't it?
Huge year. He left Sisters and starred in Clueless.
Clueless, playing Josh, the charming, smart, maybe slightly cooler, older stepbrother to Alicia Silverstone's chair.
He instantly became like the guy who could do witty dialogue and just project warmth, a certain kind of leading man was born there.
But what's interesting, and maybe people forget, is how quickly he followed that rom-com success with totally different genres. He didn't seem to want to get stuck.
Not at all. That same year, 1995, boom, he's in a horror movie, Halloween.
Right.
The Curse of Michael Myers, playing Tommy Doyle, the character from the original.
Right. And then the next year, 96, he's back in that heightened language world with Baz Luhrmann's Romeo plus Juliet.
So within like 2 years of Clueless, he hits teen comedy, slasher horror, and Shakespeare. It's like he was showing Hollywood, okay, I can do all of this.
He kept up the ensemble work too. By 99, he was in the Cider House Rules.
Yeah.
That cast got a SAG nomination, right?
Yep. Proving he could be a key piece in a successful group, a team player.
And that foundation, being good in an ensemble, it really paved the way for the Judd Apatow era, didn't it? That kicked off around 2004 with Anchorman.
Anchorman, the legend of Ron Burgundy. Brian Fantana, cologne connoisseur.
Sex Panther. His delivery is just so deadpan. Plays it completely straight amidst the chaos.
And that's the key, I think, to his success in that whole Apatow world. He could be the calm center, the professional straight man.
Letting guys like Ferrell or Carell or Rogen just go wild.
Exactly. Knowing Rudd would hold it together, that partnership really defined the mid-2000s comedies. The 40-year-old virgin in 05, then Knocked Up in 07, which Apatow wrote and directed.
And his character Pete in Knocked Up with Leslie Mann. Mm-hmm. That relationship felt so real, so recognizable.
So much so that it led to the spinoff, This Is 40, in 2012, just focusing on them.
He was kind of the secret sauce in that whole scene, wasn't he? Popping up everywhere.
Totally. Often uncredited. He was John Lennon in Walk Hard. The surf instructor Kunu in Forgetting Sarah Marshall. Little parts in Year One, Bridesmaids.
It wasn't about grabbing the spotlight.
No, it seemed more about just being part of the funniest stuff happening, collaborating.
And while all this film comedy is taking off, he lands this massive TV role that probably made him a household name globally. Mike Hannigan on Friends.
Crucial. Absolutely crucial timing. From 2002 to 2004, Friends was arguably the biggest show in the world.
And Mike wasn't just a guest star. He dates and marries Phoebe, a main character.
Right. It exposed him to this enormous audience, showed he could handle that long-form romantic storyline just before his film career fully exploded.
And then there's the weirder side of his collaborations. Like Reno 911.
Oh, yeah. He fully embraced the absurdity there. Guy Garicol, the LeMay's coach. Utterly ridiculous.
And he was in the movie too, right? Reno 911?
No.
Miami?
Yep. As a drug lord. It just shows his range, you know? Comfortably switching between Friends and that kind of niche improv-heavy comedy.
We also have to talk about the Wet Hot American Summer connection.
Yes! The ultimate cult classic. Started with the movie in 2001 where he played Andy, the sort of bad boy counselor.
And the amazing thing is, he came back for the Netflix series years later.
He did. First Day of Camp in 2015, and the other follow-ups. It shows this real loyalty, doesn't it, to the projects and the people who were there early on, no matter how big he got.
Speaking of collaborators, his chemistry with Jason Segel in I Love You, Man, that movie really worked.
It did. And that whole Rush subplot? Apparently that was real.
They're both actual huge Rush fans.
Yeah, the sources say so. Which probably added that layer of genuine connection to their friendship on screen, made it feel relatable.
He also worked with Elizabeth Banks a ton, 5 films together.
Let's see. Wet Hot, The Baxter, 40-Year-Old Virgin, Role Models, Our Idiot Brother. Yeah, 5.
That says a lot, right? The people wanted to keep working with him. Reliable, funny, professional.
Definitely speaks volumes about his reputation within the industry. And then to kind of cap off this phase, his guest spot on Parks and Recreation.
Bobby Newport. Bobby Newport's never had a real job in his life.
He was brilliant. So perfectly dim-witted but charming. Appeared in 4 episodes as Leslie Knope's rival.
And that role won him an award, didn't it?
It did. The Critics' Choice Television Award for Best Guest Performer in a Comedy Series in 2012. It was like the final proof. Paul Rudd could walk into any comedy universe and just instantly kill it. Comedy MVP. Okay, so by the early 2010s, Paul Rudd is basically the king of ensemble comedy, the go-to straight man. What's the next step? Apparently, it's becoming a global superhero lead.
Which still feels slightly audacious, right? Moving from supporting player to anchoring an MCU franchise.
Totally audacious. But the announcement came in December 2013. He was officially Scott Lang, Ant-Man.
Now, looking back, it was kind of genius casting by Marvel, wasn't it?
I think so. They needed someone who could handle the high-tech stuff, PIM particles, quantum realm, but keep it light, grounded, accessible, especially after some of the heavier stuff with Iron Man and Cap.
Rudd's persona, that sort of good-natured everyman, was perfect. He makes talking to ants feel, well, almost normal.
Right. And he became indispensable pretty quickly. The sources list 5 MCU films he's been central to.
Let's list them. Ant-Man in 2015, the first one.
Then Captain America. Civil War in 2016, where he joined the wider Avengers world.
Ant-Man and the Wasp in 2018. Avengers. Endgame in 19. Huge role there.
Crucial role. And then Ant-Man and the Wasp. Quantumania in 2023.
But the sources point out something really key beyond just acting in these. His creative input.
Yes. He co-wrote the script for Ant-Man and the Wasp.
That's significant. It wasn't just delivering lines Marvel gave him.
Exactly. It means his comedic sensibility, his timing, his way of finding humor in those crazy situations. It was baked into the franchise itself. He wasn't just an actor. He was a creative partner.
And he's not done with Marvel. Sources say he's set for Avengers. Doomsday in 2026.
Right. His tenure continues.
This leap into blockbusters wasn't just Marvel either. He jumped into another huge legacy franchise, Ghostbusters.
Mm-hmm. Took on the role of Gary Gruberson, the seismologist summer school teacher in Ghostbusters, Afterlife in 2021.
Sort of the audience's way into the news story.
Perfectly cast for that. And he came back for Frozen Empire in 2024, cementing his place in that universe too. He's good at being the guy who's suitably impressed by all the weirdness, which helps ground it for us.
But even with these massive franchises taking off, he didn't abandon the other side of the skill set, that classical training we talked about.
No, he kept a foot in dramatic work, like his supporting role in The Perks of Being a Wallflower back in 2012.
And he started doing a lot more voice work too, didn't he? Leveraging that distinct, warm voice.
Definitely. Credits like DreamWorks Monsters vs. Aliens, The Little Prince adaptation, Seth Rogen's very R-rated Sausage Party.
A different vibe there.
Very different. And also an animated film called Nerdland in 2016, playing a struggling actor.
Plus, commercially, his voice became super familiar. He's been the voice of Hyundai commercials for ages, right?
Since 2014. Mm-hmm. Nearly a decade. It's that reliable, approachable sound. It works.
He even did audiobooks. John Hodgman's Comedic Almanacs.
Yeah. The areas of my expertise and more information than you require. Again, it's that perfect straight man delivery making Hodgman's absurd writing even funnier.
Which brings us to his more recent and really significant success in prestige TV. This is where you see the dramatic depth really shine.
Absolutely. Living With Yourself on Netflix in 2019, he starred and executive produced.
Playing two roles, himself and his clone. That's a huge acting challenge.
Immense challenge. Requires so much technical skill and emotional control. And it got him that Golden Globe nomination. Big deal.
He followed that with the Shrink Next Door miniseries in 2021.
Right. And then the ultimate proof of his range, I think, comes with the 2024 Emmy nominations. 2 noms in the same year.
For wildly different things.
That's what's stunning. One was for Outstanding Supporting Actor in a Comedy Series for Only Murders in the Building.
Where he played Ben Glenroy, the actor who gets murdered in episode 1.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The victim. But he's central to the whole season through flashbacks. It says a lot about his star power that he could be the murder victim and still be such a presence.
And the second Emmy nomination that year. Couldn't be more different.
Totally different world. Outstanding narrator for a National Geographic documentary series, Secrets of the Octopus.
Wow.
Okay. Think about that. From the arrogant, murdered actor in a comedy mystery to the authoritative, warm voice explaining octopus intelligence for Nat Geo, all in the same awards year.
It really seals it, doesn't it? He can genuinely command both ends of the spectrum, high comedy and serious nonfiction. So we've got this picture of Rudd as a man of contrast, huge action, subtle comedy. But underpinning the serious side, it seems, is that consistent commitment to the stage. Going right back to that Oxford training.
That's got to be a huge part of his resilience, right? He didn't just ditch the theater once Hollywood called. He uses it, I think, to keep his skills sharp.
He did Broadway early on, The Last Night of Ballyhoo in 97.
Mm-hmm. And he kept going back to major productions. In 2006, he was in 3 Days of Rain. Star-studded cast there, Julia Roberts, Bradley Cooper.
Wow. And then Grace in 2012.
Yeah.
With Michael Shannon and Ed Asner.
Yeah. Working with really intense, respected actors, that's serious stuff.
His stage work wasn't just Broadway either. He worked in London, too.
He did. Back in 2001, he was in Long Day's Journey and Tonight over there. And then also in 2001, he was part of creating a new play, Neil LaBute's The Shape of Things, originated the role of Adam in the London production.
And that play became a movie later, right? With the same cast.
Exactly. That kind of continuity, keeping the original stage cast for the film, really shows how valued he was as a collaborator in that theater setting.
And this dedication to theater, the source is connected directly to some of his charity work, don't they?
Yeah, specifically his advocacy for stuttering awareness. Apparently, it started after he played a character who stuttered in a play.
That's powerful. Taking the experience from a role and turning it into real-world action.
It really is. Supporting the Stuttering Association for the Young essay.
Okay, so we have this foundation of serious classical stage work existing side by side with perhaps the greatest running gag in late-night television history.
Oh, the Mac and Me prank. It's legendary. An art form in itself.
It went on for so long.
Oh,
it was 2 decades.
From 2004 all the way to 2021, exclusively on Conan O'Brien's shows. Just pure comedic disruption.
Can you walk us through how it worked for anyone who might have missed this masterpiece?
Okay, so every single time Paul Rudd came on Conan's show to promote a movie, didn't matter if it was Anchorman or Ant-Man or whatever they'd chat, build up to the plug.
Conan would say something like, let's take a look at a clip.
Exactly. And instead of showing a clip from Rudd's actual new movie, Rudd would cue up the exact same scene from this terrible 1988 E.T. knockoff movie called Mac and Me.
The scene where the kid in the wheelchair goes flying off a cliff into the water is so jarring and bizarre.
Totally bizarre. And it's such a brilliant piece of, like, anti-promotion.
Mm-hmm.
Rudd himself said he'd do it because selling his movies on TV felt kind of insincere.
So this was his protest, his way of saying, I'm not taking this seriously.
Pretty much. And the genius was the commitment. Conan played the straight man perfectly, acting outraged every single time.
It became this thing the audience was in on, like a secret handshake.
Totally. Rudd said he never imagined it would go on for so long. It became this hilarious commentary on celebrity interviews. And honestly, it probably made people love him more than any real movie clip could have.
It went viral before things really went viral online.
Absolutely. And it didn't even stop when Conan's TV show ended.
Right. It followed him to the podcast world.
Yep. In 2022, Rudd shows up on Conan O'Brien Needs a Friend, the podcast, and manages to pull off an audio version of the prank, complete with the sound effects.
The commitment is just astounding. It tells you so much about his sense of humor, that slightly rebellious streak under the nice guy exterior. Okay, moving away from the career stuff to his personal life, he seems to have kept things pretty balanced, pretty grounded, despite the fame. He married Julie Yeager back in 2003.
Right. And they met, apparently, in his publicist's office where she was working at the time, which feels like a very non-Hollywood, meet-cute kind of story.
Yeah, it does. She's a screenwriter and producer now, too, right?
Mm-hmm. They live up in Rhinebeck, New York. Nice town. Apparently, a few celebs live up there. And they have two kids, a son born in 2006, daughter in 2010.
But the sources really emphasize that while he lives in New York, his heart seems to still be in the Midwest, specifically Kansas City. That loyalty is huge for him.
Oh, absolutely central to who he is. He is a massive vocal fan of Kansas City sports, the Royals and baseball.
University of Kansas Jayhawks.
And, of course, the NFL's Kansas City Chiefs. His connection to the Chiefs is especially visible.
He's basically become the voice of the Chiefs' success, hasn't he?
Pretty much. He narrated their season of HBO's Hard Knocks back in 2007, which is interesting because that was the only season the regular narrator, Liev Schreiber, didn't do it.
That says a lot about the team's connection with him.
It does. And more recently, he's narrated the Chiefs' Super Bowl recap episodes for America's Game for their wins in 2020, 2023, and 2024. He is the voice of those victories.
Okay, now for the detail that I think perfectly shows that weird blend of huge fame and small-town loyalty. The candy shop.
Samuel's Sweet Shop in Rhinebeck. Since 2014, he co-owns it with another actor, Jeffrey Dean Morgan.
And this wasn't just like, hey, let's open a candy store because we're famous.
Right.
Like, there was a reason.
A really touching reason, actually. The previous owner was a friend of theirs, and he passed away unexpectedly. They bought the shop to save it from closing down, to keep his memory going in the community.
That's incredible. Just trying to picture the logistics. You know, Ant-Man flying around the globe, but also making sure the local candy store is okay.
It completely reinforces that grounded image, doesn't it? Like, you could actually walk into Samuel's and maybe find one of the owners there, the guy who also narrates documentaries about octopuses. It's this deliberate choice to stay connected locally.
Speaking of image,
we
have to talk about the elephant in the room, or maybe the ageless man in the room. The Paul Rudd doesn't age phenomenon.
Yes. The memes are everywhere. It's a whole subgenre of internet culture.
It's so pervasive, it even made it into the MCU itself, didn't it?
It did. Sources confirm, in Deadpool and Wolverine from 2024, Deadpool finds Giant Man's corpse and quips, Paul Rudd finally aged.
When the joke makes it into your own movie universe, you know it's big.
He's become a cultural landmark for not aging.
So what's the secret? Has he finally revealed the fountain of youth?
According to Rudd himself, it's disappointingly sensible. No magic involved.
Hello.
Just discipline, which actually tracks with everything else we know about his training and work ethic. He says it's 8 hours of sleep, cardio, weights, healthy eating.
So the superhero look comes from actual hard work. Who knew?
Boring. Right. But probably true.
Beyond the discipline and the candy shop, his charity work also seems to back up that good guy image. We mentioned the stuttering advocacy.
Yeah, but his really big passion project seems to be the Big Slick. He founded it. It's this huge celebrity charity sports event in Kansas City every year.
Raising money for the Children's Mercy Hospital there.
Exactly. It's another way he brings his Hollywood network back to help his home community. Really tangible impact.
He also supports Seth Rogen's charity, Hilarity for Charity for Alzheimer's Research. Seems focused on kids and health causes.
Consistently, yeah. And finally, just touching on identity, he identifies as Jewish, but has said he's not particularly religious.
Oh.
But there was this interesting little moment when he was promoting Ghostbusters, Frozen Empire. Someone asked him who he'd talk to from history if he could. His answer, Jesus.
Oh, interesting choice for someone not particularly religious.
Right. It just adds another layer to this complex, thoughtful guy beneath the charming surface. Hashtag tag outro, synthesizing the deep dive.
Wow. Okay, what a journey we've covered. From bar mitzvah DJ and holiday ham glazer.
Don't forget the second cousin, English immigrant parents.
Right. Through competitive speaking, Jacobean drama, all the way to co-writing MCU films and owning a small town candy shop, is quite the arc.
It really is. And I think the so what of it all, the key takeaway, is that his career is this masterclass in balancing opposites.
Oh, so?
Well, you've got the deep technical commitment to the craft, the stage work, the dramatic range, that's the foundation.
Okay.
But it's perfectly paired with this self-deprecating humor, this refusal to take the whole fame thing too seriously, like the Mac and Me gag. That went on for 20 years.
The ultimate example.
Exactly. And that blend of, like, sincerity about the work but mockery of the promotion, it creates this incredible authenticity, makes him seem approachable even when he's, you know, Ant-Man.
And the Kansas City connection, the charity stuff, the candy store. It all reinforces that grounded feeling.
Totally. And he has been formally recognized, of course. Got his star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame back in 2015, number 2,554.
And his quote, when he got it, was so perfectly Rudd, wasn't it? Something like, I remember being a kid walking here thinking, who's that?
Exactly. Total humility, that every man perspective still intact.
So we end up with this guy whose voice, I mean, it can go from Brian Fantana to narrating Secrets of the Octopus and earning an Emmy nod for it.
That voice of approachable intelligence, it's kind of his superpower, maybe.
Maybe it is. We've seen him move seamlessly between co-writing superhero movies and doing serious stage drama. Given that incredible versatility and that recent Emmy nomination for narration, what else could he narrate?
Ooh, good question.
What other complex historical or scientific subjects do you think are just waiting for that Paul Rudd touch, that perfect mix of warmth and smarts?
That's a great thought to leave people with. What should Paul Rudd narrate next?
Something for you to think about. Thanks for diving deep with us today.